This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Dane Fitzgerald. Dane, it's great talking to you.
Yeah, you too. I met you a couple months ago, Bay Area, by chance.
Oh yeah, the Futurist Meetup.
Yeah, I guess it's not really by chance, actually. I mean, it was a Futurist Meetup, but partially by chance.
I'm also joined here with my co-host, Joshua Zeidner.
Great to be on the show again, Robert. Always a pleasure.
Dane, you've written for a number of sites. American Spectator is one of them, and Secular Right's the other.
Correct. Yeah, Secular Right started up years ago with a little fanfare. I think even the Wall Street Journal talked about it. But since then, a lot of people who contribute to it kind of fell off, and it's mainly Razib Khan now, Andrew Stutterford, and myself. And those guys are way, way more prestigious than I, especially Razib lately. But yeah, I mean, they've written for, or Andrew Stutterford's written for NRO and Wall Street Journal. Kind of like conservatism 1.0, if that's the way you can put it, rather than the kind of alt-right new kids on the block.
Do you identify with more conservatism or more of the alt-right?
More conservatism, I'd say. I'm probably of the age I should identify a little more with the alt-right, but I'm more cuckish and economics and, you know, sort of policy-oriented, I guess, in my outlook, even though I'm not a policy wonk. I don't have enough culture warrior fight in me, probably.
What generally passes for conservatism in the Silicon Valley?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I think what passes for conservatism here wouldn't pass for conservatism in much of the country. But over here, it's all relative to the social justice set. And so a kind of like milquetoast conservative or gray tribe libertarianish person is definitely on the right out here.
And you grew up in Sacramento. Can you describe Sacramento and what is it like growing up there?
Sacramento's in the shadow of the Bay Area. If it were in the middle of the country, it might be kind of a worthwhile city or notable city in its own right. But, yeah, I grew up there in the 80s, in South Sacramento, which is like a lot of south parts of town, not the greatest part of town. Not that I was like, you know, impoverished or anything like that, but, yeah, growing up there was not, particularly political in any sense. But I think maybe I was exposed to more multiculturalism in a kind of organic way, not in just kind of a silly textbook or corporate HR policy kind of way. So that's maybe another reason why I don't resonate too much with alt-right. You know, I was playing, you know, backyard baseball with, you know, the Vietnamese kid who lived right behind me and had, you know, black friends, and although no real Jewish friends, though. Maybe that, I feel like that's more like an East Coast thing. They're just white people here. A Sacramento childhood. I don't know. I have fond memories of Nintendo, but that's not really Sacramento-centric. I like, yeah, that's nothing Sacramento-specific about that. Or Toys R Us, which is being shuttered, apparently, across the country. Yeah, it's kind of not a very notable place, all in all.
I briefly lived in Fresno. Is it sort of... It's nicer than Fresno, probably.
It is probably nicer than Fresno. It's the best thing going on in the Central Valley. Probably, definitely. But that's not saying too much, you know?
Did you move to the Bay Area for college or for work?
For college, actually. My girlfriend at the time, she was going to go to Bolt Law School, UC Berkeley, and I was accepted at the prestigious San Jose State, being sarcastic. And so we lived in Castro Valley, which is kind of a compromise between the locations of San Jose and Berkeley. And then from Castro Valley, I ended up in Oakland, where I've been ever since. Couldn't afford to live in the city. At this point, I'm aging out of caring much about that.
Do you have a favorite part of the Bay Area?
I guess it's more or less where I'm at. I do like all that core Bay Area stuff, all of the cultural offerings and basically a singles mecca and that kind of thing. I don't really ever go to the North Bay. There's nothing really going on up there except residential stuff. It's very high-end. I work in the South Bay at Samsung in Mountain View. So I commute down there a lot. It takes about 2 hours. In fact, I was a few minutes late for this interview because I left work at 4:58.
Oh, wow.
Like someone who thought 2 hours would be enough time to go 40 miles into the Bay Area.
Yeah, I remember on my last trip just the traffic on the 680 from Fremont to about Dublin area. That was really bad. And that's outside of the Bay Area. Or not outside, but in sort of far out there.
Dublin is a little bit Fremont's Bay Area. Dublin is still considered the Bay Area. It's just kind of east Bay. More all golden brown hills that are never green. It's kind of the difference between that side of the hill and then the Berkeley side.
I stayed in Walnut Creek. That area is pretty scenic. Especially towns like Lafayette and Orinda.
Yeah, those are very green right in there, actually. I think it has more to do with how upscale it is right through there. They make sure the water gets to the leafy residential high-end neighborhoods. If it was, if nature had its druthers, it'd be just brown as shit in there, too.
Well, I actually like the Golden Hills.
Yeah? Yeah, I prefer green, but it's nicer than, I don't know, Bakersfield? You know, I mean, brown hills look a little nicer than Mad Max land.
Isn't Oakland, has that been gentrifying a lot since you've lived there?
You know, not as much as media hype would have it. The ability to talk about gentrification is like outpacing the ability to actually follow through on it, I think. But it is happening still. But it's funny, Sacramento has seen more gentrification like in the Midtown area than Oakland has in its, you know, kind of downtown and adjacent areas. There's still kind of a rough edge here that makes people not be too gung-ho about moving too fast on it, you know?
Yeah, I remember when I drove through with my friend, a lot of it does seem pretty run down. There's like a massive homeless encampment like just off the freeway west of downtown.
Yeah, it's that I think is happening faster than gentrification is. Yeah, it's weird that people spend so much, they pay out the nose more than they ever have to you step over human shit on the street. And I mean literally human shit. I'm not, you know, calling people human shit. And, you know, and I don't, that's one thing I think, for instance, that a kind of econ-oriented conservative mindset wouldn't have anticipated, that people would, for some reason, opt to live in that.
There was some article recently where they had some sort of an app that tells you where there is likely to be human feces in the city of San Francisco.
Oh, really?
They've literally developed an internet app to help people navigate
Oh, yeah. I just human waste. Just walking around downtown San Francisco, you see people relieving themselves right out into the open.
Yeah, it's been going on for a while. It's been an ongoing homeless problem.
Yeah, it seems like pretty much the Tenderloin, I'm betting, is where 90% of those human poop incidents are happening.
That's kind of where it was.
Yeah, apparently Twitter headquarters is right in there, but I...
Yeah, basically right across the street from Twitter headquarters.
Yeah, they must keep kind of a low profile. I don't think I've ever even walked by it or anything. I'm in there a lot.
Oh, I went to the DNA, I think it's the DNA Lounge to see this concert that's right over kind of in that area. That was south of Market, but it's a few blocks from the Twitter headquarters.
Okay. Yeah, DNA Lounge. You're into like synthwave and stuff, right?
It was an FM84 concert.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that name per se. I'm not familiar with that name. But I know about that space, and I enjoy some of it. I like Future Cop and people like that. Perturbator, Protector 101. Anyway, yeah, at DNA Lounge, I think they host a lot of shows like that. And it has a kind of a cool, like New York City 1991 nightclub look or something in there. Like full-on proper, you know?
Joshua, didn't you say you also lived in the Bay Area when you were working in tech?
Yeah, I lived in Palo Alto, and I've actually been to the Tenderloin. We spent a night or two out there, went to some party or some kind of get-together or something like that.
Yeah, Palo Alto, Tenderloin. This could not be more different.
Well, I was living in Palo Alto, and we went out to the Tenderloin. But yeah, they are dramatically different places, and I remember I was inside Kleiner Perkins, and I told some of the people there that I was in the Tenderloin, not knowing anything about San Francisco, and they're like looking at me kind of like, why were you there? Like I was picking up drugs or something. But
yeah, it feels like something like how you would expect New York City to feel in the 70s.
Yeah, in a way.
I mean, it does. Definitely resembles it. Me being somebody who was there, at least during the 80s and 90s. Very similar.
You were in New York City in the 80s and 90s?
Yes. I grew up on Long Island.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Well, I was a kid. But it was definitely a very exciting time. I don't know how topical this is, but it was a really cheap place to live. I think that's really what it comes down to, and there were just loads of opportunities for anybody. And people were just living in lofts, converted factory spaces, all sorts of stuff. I think it's going to happen again in one of the major cities somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, Oakland is, in a way, still kind of holding it down for that idea, you know, the best it can.
How do you see Oakland in about, like, 20 years from now?
At the pace that gentrification is going, I don't see it being all that different. I mean, I don't know. I've been in my apartment, in my little corner. I've been here for 5 years, and not very much has changed. So 4 times what I've seen is not too much change. And like I said, West Oakland still feels like it's many decades away from turning into some kind of, you know, financial district SF, like right off the bridge or something. It's not even close to anything like that.
You wrote an article for the American Spectator entitled Meet the New Boss, and you said that millennials were perhaps the most well-behaved generation in history. What do you mean by that?
Just a lot of the social indicators about, you know, excess drinking, drugs, sex, they don't really seem to be too high on that, if you will. It just seems like a kind of anxious button-down generation. You said millennial? I guess more accurately, Generation Z. You want to get all specific, you know, 25-year-olds, you know, maybe up to 30. But, they seem kind of hunkered down and cocooned and working on polishing their resume rather than just, like, taking off to train hop or something.
Do you identify more with Generation X?
You know what? I do identify more with Generation X. I'm technically a really young Gen Xer. I was born in late 78. And millennial, I think, is you have to have been born at least in 80. Yeah, I mean, I was influenced by my older brother growing up. I like I'm more into 80s stuff than 90s. It's kind of another giveaway where my sensibilities are. Although I do like the stuff I discovered through raving or, affiliated with raving after high school, and artists like Aphex Twin and Autechre and stuff like that, Warp Records. I'm realizing how much of a predictable kind of background I have for someone who's into the kind of politics I have, you know?
And I notice a lot of times that millennials or people who are sort of roughly in that age category, they never want to associate with their own age group. You ever notice that? They always seem to want to prove that they have that they're either not a millennial or they identify better with a time period outside of millennialism. Why do you think that is?
Huh. Well, I mean, they do have the past, like, at their disposal in a way earlier generations didn't, you know. They can always go to YouTube, indulge in everything that older generations were into. So that's, like, in 1988, you couldn't have just, you know, wilded away, is that the term? Idled away or whatever, all your time just indulging in past stuff. I mean, I guess you could have listened to your dad's records, but, you know, whatever. Just, it's not, you could totally immerse yourself in the past in a way that you just could not before. And maybe that makes them identify with older people or something.
Well, they seem to be wanting to escape the stereotypes. That's what my impression is.
Yeah.
That they're somewhat desperate to have people label them as something other than a millennial. You know, they're a very controversial generation.
Well, they are talked about probably more than any other group. Although, I mean, like, baby boomers, they have, like, such a huge they came before them and have been talked about way more. Like, the total amount of, like, articles and everything being put out there now is greater than ever before. So Gen Z and millennials are, like, catching up to the amount of discussion that's been had about baby boomers, but baby boomers came first, and so they have a huge advantage in that way.
Sure. So do you mind if I ask a couple of questions about politics? Is this a good time,
sure.
Robert?
Or... Sure, go ahead.
Okay, so, I mean, when did you first decide you were not a liberal?
I think it more happened... maybe mid-2000s, because I only kind of got into politics after high school. It was kind of a late bloomer. It wasn't until I was maybe like 20 or something I started, you know, listening to talk radio. I was a pizza delivery guy, and I listened to like Michael Medved and like people like that. Michael Savage was a little too much. It was like a guilty pleasure, and I caught myself going like, no, I can't. It's just too much. He starts yelling, and I feel like it's just anti-intellectual. I just couldn't do it. Michael Medved had more of like a softer tone and seem more sensible. But what's funny is that I was sort of like just kind of like talk radio conservative, not very in depth. But then I started getting into libertarianism, and I bought a lot of their rhetoric about how we libertarians really belong on the left. We're actually much more left wing than a lot of the so-called left. So I kind of considered myself, like, because I was so anti-war and everything, some kind of hard leftist. Then I realized I'm only kind of judging that on one dimension of, like, imperialism or something, and that there's so much more. And I kind of started to think outside of, like, the rhetoric within libertarian circles and realized there's so free market. Of course it's on the right. You know, these left and right terms, they change over time. And, you know, I realized, okay, I'm definitely on the right. And then in the last few years with the hard cultural turn on the left, it's almost like kind of by default, I found myself pretty conservative because I just could not be on board with all that. And I still kind of consider myself sort of like, you know, soft conservative, even sort of old fashioned liberal. I mean, I like websites like Quillette, or Aereo magazine, kind of, I don't know, right-leaning gray tribe type material.
So you're not like a big fan of say Breitbart?
No, yeah, I don't. I was briefly considering working at Breitbart. There's a guy I know. Oh my god, his name escapes me. Shit. Now, see, now if it comes to me, it'll be offensive to this person, so I should not even say it. But I almost had a gig working at Breitbart. I decided I didn't really want to be associated with it because it just seemed too not self-critical enough and just a little too tribal.
I noticed you did link to the Owens review on your blog.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think Owens review, it has a reputation as kind of hard right, but a lot of the material is kind of from all over the place. I think maybe it's because Steve Saylor is such like a big figure there. And the way that like Rod Dreher is at the American Conservative, they end up giving, coloring people's perception of it the most.
Are you a fan of Saylor's work?
Yeah. But because of where I live and the kind of crowd I have to, engage with, I couldn't really be the sassy culture warrior he is. I have to be more careful in how I would word things. He's a little too flippant, but I do read him, yeah.
Yeah, he writes mostly about demographic issues.
Yeah.
What do you think is the most interesting thing that Steve Saylor has had to say in his blog?
Well, I think he documents the kind of casual anti-white guyism that's coming seemingly from everywhere lately. But in a way, it's, I don't know, he's like the hammer who sees everything as a nail. It's like there's no place that's so obscure online that he wouldn't link to it to be more evidence of the anti-white guyism. So, you know, I try to be careful not to start being very selective and actually looking for a phenomenon that I think is damaging and then end up overstating the case, you know.
What do you think about the whole Google memo case with James Damore? This happened, I think it was a couple months ago.
Yeah, I think it's silly. I think that the reaction to that is proof that, you know, it is really getting as bad as people think. People on the kind of old-fashioned liberal side or the right-wing side. I thought it was interesting that right after that happened, they did a survey of a lot of the employees of a bunch of Silicon Valley companies, and I wouldn't say overwhelmingly, but maybe overwhelmingly. It was a majority of people thought it was silly that he had been fired for that. And the only company where a majority thought it wasn't silly was LinkedIn. And that's actually kind of telling because that's like a company that's entirely about HR in a way. You know, it's just about networking and presenting a certain self. And, yeah, I thought that was funny that they agreed with his firing. And oddly, I think maybe Lyft did as well. That wouldn't seem strange, but you know, all these other companies.
Which is also a highly politicized company, clearly.
Yeah. Yeah.
You wrote something interesting about James Damore that he suspects that he's on the autism spectrum, and you said something about the neurodiversity cause. What are your thoughts on that?
There's a evolutionary psychologist named Jeffrey Miller who wrote an article for Quillette about, you know, the neurodiversity case for, you know, tolerating opinions like James Damore. And I think it's kind of an interesting way to fit conservative arguments into a framework that the left is comfortable with. And, you know, increasingly just the media in general seems to want to view everything. But I don't know if that'll work, if it threatens to explode everything else that they care about, you know? So, I don't know, but maybe this is funny, maybe this is an opinion I should keep to myself so that it can work, right? I mean, the arguments that we make publicly end up affecting the outcome of a certain argument, and it can be like a self-fulfilling prophecy, but, you know, I don't know. Yeah, I think that might be straining the notion of diversity too, if it results in these more established kinds of diversity, like, you know, racial and gender considerations somehow being undermined. I think the left is going to be onto it, and they're going to be like, no.
You wrote an article for American Spectator, Asian American leaders are scarce in Silicon Valley. Can you explain that, and why do you think that's the case?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was... Yeah, so Silicon Valley is... Asians are overrepresented here, and not, I mean, in an absolute sense too, I think slightly more than 50%, and not just relative to, you know, percentages in the population, but Yeah, so, you know, the technical smarts, the ability to do all of this very technical work could be very well represented in the Asian population, but leadership is a different kind of skill set, which they don't necessarily want to take advantage of. And it by no means means that they're, like, somehow, you know, getting the shaft or whatever. And where I work at Samsung, you know, most of the leadership, too, is also Asian, South and East. But, yeah, I linked to some study in there, too. I don't want to try to remember what it said, but, yeah, it was something about, like, displayed interest in leadership roles and just, you know, micro experiments involving, like, I don't know, speaking up or just, you know, letting bygones be bygones. And yeah, so.
I actually want to make a comment on some of the things you were saying earlier, if you don't mind. So you said you're sort of in the zone of libertarianism in Silicon Valley. What do you think of Peter Thiel?
I don't really have any strong opinion there, or even a mild one, I guess. I mean, I think the kind of things he says are agreeable for the most part. I mean, I know he spoke at the RNC function last year. Yeah, I haven't really read. I know he had some book about Zero to Hero. No, I'm just being facetious, but the word zero is in there somewhere. And
he's often sort of portrayed as this person who is the figurehead for libertarian thinking in Silicon Valley, at least probably more so maybe 10 years ago. I think some of his surface popularity has waned, although I don't think his influence has. And, you know, yeah, he's sort of the person who brokered a lot of these early social media ideas and put them together. He was also founder of PayPal, I believe a founder, or at least a major antagonist. So
yeah, I've had a headache trying to use PayPal, but I do use Venmo, which is apparently PayPal too. But yeah, he's one of those people that, you know, around here that or that people around here have, like, strong opinions of. They've read his book. I'm more interested in just kind of like like you mentioned earlier, demographics, Robert, about, like, kind of the demographics of Silicon Valley and how that affects is related to ideology in a kind of, like, sociology of knowledge way, right? Like, I think it's interesting that these kind of dorky Asian and white guys are kind of into Bitcoin, and then these, you know, UC Berkeley activists are, you know, either have no opinion or they're hostile to it because they know who is into it. I'm not really into any kind of particular figure that looms large in Silicon Valley, but I am interested in the way I think the demographics that play out here in the way that, like, these kind of worldviews are attached to certain types of people, the way that kind of portends what is going to happen here, I think, in the years to come. I think there's going to be some kind of it's going to come to a head. This kind of, you know, C.P. Snow wrote about the two cultures, but there's now a huge, like, racial and gender element to that clash. I think it's going to make it even worse.
So what exactly do you think is going to happen? What's your prediction? Let's say in 10 years. It sounds like you think there's going to be a crisis of some sort.
Well,
so maybe describe what you think that crisis is going to look like.
I don't know.
I tend to agree, by the way. I mean, I think...
Yeah.
I think the social and economic situation there certainly is not long-term viable. Just look at the pension system, for instance. I mean, it's...
Oh, yeah.
They're headed for something real nasty.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I used to spend a lot more time thinking about economics. But I came to the conclusion... Well, I was really into Austrian economics, no big surprise. And I ended up being... influenced by the editor of a journal called Critical Review, and that the guy's name is Jeffrey Friedman, and he pointed out all of the flaws in libertarian thinking and how a lot of what the conclusions they came to economically were really driven by a kind of a very normative kind of libertarianism where everything the government touches is bad. And so I kind of gave up on microeconomics. So as far as the pension type stuff, I still think microeconomics and supply and demand and all that kind of stuff, on a basic level, is very useful and distinguishes me from the populist left or something. But yeah, I don't know about the pension thing. I mean, maybe, I don't know. People have been complaining about federal deficit in the way California's finances have been going for a long time, and yet it doesn't seem like some kind of crisis has happened.
Would you say economically you're fairly centrist and pragmatist?
Yeah, much more than I used to be. But part of the reason I started getting more into culture is because, not to sound tautological, but like the culture at large, everybody else became increasingly obsessed with it. And it seems like it's impossible to have a conversation about economics without people wanting to first talk about, why are so many white guys into that? Why do so many white guys like Bitcoin or something? You know, it's like, shit, if it's going to be impossible to talk about the merits of intellectual property or eminent domain without getting past this culture shit first, then we're going to have to move to culture, you know? And I guess in a way, the alt-right is correct, in sensing that somehow. But it's funny, you talk to alt-right people about economics and they sound like, a lot of times, like, the populist left. It's just, they ascribe everything to evil machinations of some rich person, or, you know, they don't think of it as some kind of like value neutral process, you know. I'm still too much of a old-fashioned econ type conservative to not see it as more of a process than something villainous, you know, or whatever. But Joshua, you were saying about coming to a head in California, but I think I don't see like a specific crisis, like some kind of riot or whatever, but I just think that kind of at the street level, just our daily interactions, seems like it gets more and more tense, you know. I could see where you get to a point where just, you know, two white guys and an Asian guy walk into a bar, and like, you know, a trans person and their two women of color friends just kind of like sneer it and walk away, or just don't even want to engage them. So it's like this kind of low level toxic kind of erosion of civil society stuff, I think.
Well, I mean, I notice like a lot of millennials, maybe, I don't know what your exact age is, they often seem to be unaware that there were riots in California at one point, and not so, in fairly recent history. You know, you had all the LA riots, and people have gone berserk before in California. And, you know, that wasn't the first time.
Yeah, it's funny when you think about, I mean, I remember the LA riots. My dad was, in LA at the time, and he said people walking by going fucking honky, you know. And he said I could feel the tension in the air. And so, but I mean, if you go back to the '60s, it was worse than that. It would be like,
sure,
there's so many nights in a row of that, you know, and all around the country too.
What we were talking about before with the homeless population in San Francisco, you know, that very easily could convert into a real civil disorder problem if, you know, those people were motivated enough and organized enough to really cause some damage, you know, if they were targeting a neighborhood or something like that. You know, there's a fine line between homeless and, I don't know what you would call it, vandal. Somebody who's instigating real, you know, problems.
Yeah, it would probably happen when an upper-middle-class activist comes in to rile them up. Something more organic would be like the police to swoop in and start tearing down everyone's tents. That would be an organic homeless uprising. But I don't know. I mean, did you hear about what happened in San Diego? You hear about what happened in San Diego a couple weeks ago? There was like a minor hepatitis A outbreak because of human feces around. And like, when I heard about that, that's not the same thing as like a civil disorder of like the scary riot kind. But in a way, it's something biological even more scary. And I just feel like San Francisco, oh my God. I mean, if it can happen in San Diego, which isn't as dense and which is really, frankly, just nicer, than right under the Oakland freeway, or San Francisco is like a tinderbox.
It's a very unequal city, you know, as far as economics goes.
It's
not so surprising. Like, you know, given it's the home of liberalism, yet it seems to be very unfair. You know, there's a huge marginalized population. They seem to be mostly white.
Yeah, pretty much everyone is either wealthy or homeless, and there's no middle ground.
Right.
And
that's a trend that's been going on all over the country, like this rising cost of living to the point where, it's, I don't know, I tend to think, I guess this is kind of a theory, that it's because the same people, you know, they found a way, these corporations found a way to own the real estate wherever they provide jobs for. So it's like almost working for the company store. You know, your money basically goes straight back into, you know, the people. They like, you know, your employer's paying you, and that money's going straight back to them. And that's true for
I don't know, though, but you think, like, because the people who work at Twitter, they're renting from Twitter?
Well, what they're doing is they're mortgaging properties that are managed by corporations that are owned in conjunction with Twitter. That's certainly going on. There's no question that's going on to some extent, you know, but that raises a lot of questions like, you know, is that somehow a violation of some kind of ethical principle? Is that good or bad for Americans?
Oh, yeah. Like, I've seen those. There was some proposal to build housing for workers on the tech campuses. Have you seen those?
They wanted to create an entire city. I think it was either Google, maybe Microsoft, one of the major tech giants, wanted to actually incorporate a city somewhere, either in Washington or Oregon or California. So they wanted to own the entire town. So in other words, you know, basically the city hall is run and governed and owned by your employer. Can you imagine something like that?
yeah, it is like company towns, but I mean, yeah, no, I'm no expert on like urban policy or this per se, but I mean, most people who like work at, who are trying to like, who are working in the city and trying to afford to live there, they don't pay mortgages. You know, they rent from some property management company around here.
Right.
Lapham. So I don't think, you know, working for and paying rent to the same people, unless it's being done in some very indirect way that, you know, I'm not privy to, is really the issue.
Well, what's preventing those property management firms from being on the same board of directors as, you know, the employers?
I don't know. They move in different circles in different industries.
Is there
one like board of directors for rich people in general, or don't they have a bunch of different corporate boards?
Well, I guess that poses the issue of like class warfare. You know, is it not? It's not so much like, you know, one corporation in competition with another, but rather, you know, these different classes that are sort of working in collaboration to disenfranchise another class. And, you know, that's a lot of Americans' experience right now. I mean, I think Robert even said that there's like this feeling that you're either homeless and you own nothing, or you're rich and you own everything and you don't have to work at all. And that's the kind of scenario that leads to bankruptcy fairly quickly.
There's some term they use for people who are not, they're above homeless, way below rich. It's precariat. It's just kind of one of those terms, like precarious proletariat. Like they're trying to just hold on. And they're like, you know, it's just amazing that, you know, my dad would steal cars as a teenager. He would bring them back, or so he says, but, you know, he would take them for joyrides. He also, you know, knocked up. Oh my God, I shouldn't say too much. Anyway, you could rebound from things back in the day like that. I don't think you can really do that.
Sure, today. Hey, you can make a Facebook post, and that's the end of your life.
Right.
Today. Unbelievable how much it's changed.
People feel very precarious, and that's why I think younger people are well behaved, just because they can look at all variety of like pornographic material in a way that like even I couldn't really. I mean, kind of. Maybe that only really started when I was well into my 20s, but it doesn't mean they're even remotely acting on all of that or the crazy Punisher violence, whatever. So they really just kind of, they live it all, through all of those crazy things vicariously through Netflix. They don't have a prayer of being able to really do that and come back from it in a way that like previous generations could.
So Josh, are you the guy I met? This is off topic, I guess, but were you the guy I met at the Futurist thing with Robert?
No, I don't
know. No, that was someone else.
Okay.
No. That was probably Sam.
I wouldn't know.
No, I know his name, but he doesn't like to have his name mentioned on the show. We were talking about the whole issues of income inequality. What do you think about the debate about housing in the Bay Area?
Well, I think, see, I think it is more just a, I don't think it's any kind of nefarious plot. I just think given the geography and the fact that like all mature cities, develop these bureaucratic hurdles, it just makes it more and more difficult to build shit. And unfortunately, that's coinciding with fewer and fewer jobs in just a few, wealthy, metros. So it seems like the places that were, you know, a big deal 100 years ago or an even bigger deal now. And then like a lot of places that were in addition to those big deal places have all, you know, hit like hard times. So like 100 years ago, like, New York, San Francisco, DC, Philadelphia. Well, I, you know, not Philadelphia, but these places, New York and LA are important. And they've only gotten more important. DC was important, has gotten more important, but there used to be additional places that were doing okay, Chicago, Cleveland, whatever, and they're not doing okay anymore. And so it's like that you've got to be basically in like five places to have some like thriving career. And it seems like, yeah, they're not building homes fast enough.
And well, so, you know, have you ever heard the term NIMBY, NIMBYism?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which stands for not in my backyard. And, you know, it's like a collection of political tactics that existing property owners use to make sure that, you know, their neighborhood doesn't turn into a crowded zone.
Yeah.
And that's basically the story of the Bay Area.
It's funny. Everyone is like against NIMBYism. And then it comes to, you know, some dive bar that is like, so it's like even like a childless person who doesn't really own property can kind of fall into this too. It's like, oh man. That dive bar where I saw all those great shows, and it's been there since like 1941, and they're gonna tear that down. I'm gonna sign this petition to make sure they preserve that place. You know, it's like we all, especially when you start to like fetishize some hipster area that you've tried hard to move into, you want to like keep all those little things too. You know, not just an old church or cathedral or something, but like every little spot under the sun, you want to preserve that too, and then you end up contributing to a NIMBY mindset.
So you're saying in a place like the Bay Area, it's hard to build massive amounts of new housing without destroying, like, wilderness or historic architecture?
Pretty much, their argument.
That's the argument.
Yeah. It doesn't actually have to be that way if you consider just, like, you could just build up and up.
Yeah, like, but you could take, I'm sure there's, like, parking lots or strip malls that could be turned into high-rises.
Yeah. And, like, there might be an argument for, in a place like, you know, Financial District of San Francisco, that there's a limit to that because that would still make the crowds down on the street just get bigger and bigger, you know? Because you still, you know, live most of your life, you know, just down at street level, or at least. Oakland and stuff is still way, way spacious enough that they could do a lot of that.
Yeah, I think there are. You're saying Oakland could accommodate like a lot of new high rises, and I think there are like proposals.
There's also the public transit's part of that equation too. So it's, you know, maybe they won't build high rises in Palo Alto, but they'll build them somewhere else that's cheaper, and then run, you know, like a light rail or something between the two places, so that the poor people can go to the places of employment in Palo Alto. And they'll typically resist those sorts of programs as well, too. It's really a kind of a selfish mindset. You know, like they're in favor of, the NIMBYists are in favor of development as long as they make money on it. But once it goes past the point where they benefit from it, you know, someone else is benefiting from the development, then they're against it. So it's very much a double standard.
Yeah, I think the place is most resistant to building new housing is, by housing, I mean, like, apartments too, but, is a place like Palo Alto, where it's all like, you know, low to the ground, but very expensive, high priced homes, where these people who may themselves own apartment buildings where they live. And they're like, no, I can't do that. I mean, I'm all in on building like a 300 story skyscrapers over in West Oakland or something, which I think would happen like, you know, 50 years from now, not 20. But they're like, you know, I'm not going to do that in the leafy neighborhood where I live. No way. I don't want that mess down here. So in a way, Palo Alto is kind of worse than like, San Francisco or Oakland.
Well, yeah, well, I mean, that's what California has turned into. It's kind of like this state that revolves around benefiting a very small pocket of people. You know, they're typically boomers. And, you know, they jumped on a wave sometime between the 70s and 80s, and they don't want to get off the ride. You know, they kind of see themselves as they made it, and everyone else has to eat their scraps, and that's how it is. But, you know, if enough people sort of start to see things that way, you know, start to see the reality for what it is, then they can challenge that. And the pension system is a perfect example. There's no way that the state of California can guarantee those same benefits to workers in the future that they guarantee to all these workers between the late 70s and early 90s. It's financially impossible.
Yeah. Yeah. See, I said earlier that I don't know enough about macroeconomics, but I'm like 90% certain that has to be true. I mean, if anything, okay, so the federal government has access to the treasury and we're like the reserve currency. So in a way, they just can owe it to themselves. They can just, you know, print more money or add more zeros. But states still kind of have to try to get their budgets in order. They just can't go on forever, right?
They can sell, municipal bonds, and that's typically the way that they do it. But as we all know, what was it, like 10 years ago, California essentially went bankrupt. I don't know if they legally did that on paper. And the result of that is you can't market those municipal bonds because municipal bonds basically saying, you know, you give someone $5, buy the bond, and they give and the seller of the bond gives you $7 back.
Yeah, sometimes
unless they go bankrupt. So if you go bankrupt, they won't pay you anything.
So California has now established that it can go bankrupt and will go bankrupt and not pay out. So it's like
absolutely.
It's shot or something like that.
Right? That's exactly how it works. Yeah. So California can't borrow anymore. Now they can't finance anything. It really works it's very like deterministic. It's kind of like if someone keeps spending money, but they never make any money, and they don't really make any wise investments or do anything constructive with that cash, and they can't pay the creditors back, then they stop giving them money. That's basically what's going to happen in California. People like us, you know, in our age group, we lived through a time when that started, and, you know, we're used to this normality of just borrowing your way into success. Yeah. And there's going to be a time in the future when we're going to learn that that's not going to, it does not work that way.
What originally attracted you to the whole futurist scene?
Futurism per se is not, I don't really think very much about. I guess in a way, just kind of sociologically, the futurist crowd overlaps with libertarians and then sort of post-libertarians, which is where I'd put myself in. Just to say real quick, post-libertarianism is like libertarianism, but it feels much less normative. They will ascribe a lot of the problems to like cognitive errors rather than people being sheeple or somehow buying into state propaganda. It's a somewhat more charitable kind of libertarianism in explaining how people think. The Gray Tribe is like significantly libertarian. And then also kind of like scientifically literate liberal. And I gravitate to that space, which is kind of loosely called futurist. Maybe very loosely. And maybe even the reason we think of that is because it's like the only thing left over after you think of these other groups that are clearly not futurist. So what if you think of it as almost like futurist by default, you know?
Are you interested in transhumanism?
Not really. I do read Scott Alexander. I'm a big fan of Scott Alexander's blog. But whenever he doesn't do things about that are some kind of analysis of like tribal conflict, ideology and psychology and things like that, when he starts talking about some, I don't know, Robert Heinlein novel or something that Sam Harris said about meditation and cognitive wherewithal and just, I don't know, Fitbit or I don't know, something all of that space, I kind of tune out. So I'm still kind of interested in political science and political theory.
On your Twitter profile, you wrote, "There is opposition to genetic enhancement in the West. Countries such as China and India are more positive."
Oh, that's something I retweeted. I didn't use those words. But yeah, see, even there, I'm interested in that to the degree that it says something about an ideology that's taken hold in the West that puts a kind of, I guess I'll use the term cultural Marxist and egalitarian spin on things and feels suspicious of science. I suspect because they correctly link it to things that nerdy white and Asian males like, and that there's, yeah, again, getting back to the kind of two cultures thing, the humanities and the sciences. And I think it's interesting how that might, you know, how not might, but will continue to be like a kind of tension. Like journalists at large just seem like, I don't know what it is. They just, they're just kind of hostile to like the James Damores of the world, you know?
Oh, so you're saying your key interest in futurism is not so much particularly transhumanism, but just being a pro-science in general and sort of technology and logic-based arguments?
Right. Yeah, so it's not so much transhumanism, it's transhumanists. You know, I'm kind of interested in them as a group and their general worldview and where that falls politically, you know?
Yeah, the genetics thing. So what exactly is your interest in, like, human genetics? I find that topic personally interesting.
I don't really have any strong interest in human genetics. And even though I like people like Razib Khan and Steve Saylor, and I mean, I'm no expert on, like, population genetics or biology, but if you get a good overview of the conversation itself, you'll see that clearly they're closer to the truth than, you know, journalists are in just the kind of pop sociology angle that informs so much of what we see on in narratives and in TV and film, you know. So yeah, so you know, something like races exist. Yeah, they do exist, you sure. know. It's not, I remember when I was in community college, Cosumnes River College in South Sacramento, we watched a documentary that said that race didn't exist. It's bogus, but then went on to claim that, you know, we had to pretend like it did anyway to correct, past injustice. And I remember thinking to myself, if it doesn't exist, how the hell do you know who you're helping and who you're trying to help and who you're not? And how do you identify people by race if race doesn't exist? It just seemed incoherent to me. It's like
there's certainly like a deal of censorship, I think, you know, that kind of comes, as you say, from the pop science realm and what's, you know, publicly acceptable, because we live in a world today where if you say something that's even remotely offensive or abrasive to some racial group, you're going to have unbelievable levels of, you know, backlash. So yeah. I think that a lot of the science is somewhat, you know, they kind of take the corners off, to say the least, especially when it comes to genetics, about the story that the facts actually tell. You know, and really, human genetics is a story of winners and losers. And that's how it is. So,
this is a slightly off topic, but you wrote a post on Facebook about Harvey Weinstein and how that kind of relates to the concept of the left as being the moral, and especially Hollywood being the moral compass of America.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that was something about Lena Dunham being one of the few people that would, like, criticize Harvey Weinstein. That seems really dated now. I mean, now everybody is. But, like, yeah, for the first few days, it was strangely kind of muted about it. Apparently Saturday Night Live didn't do anything.
Oh, yeah, they didn't do anything.
Now this coming Saturday Night Live, you know they will be. They will be all over it.
Well, Seth MacFarlane made a joke about it several years ago.
Yeah, it's funny how that came back. Yeah, and it's funny, too, because Seth MacFarlane, you would think, might be, like, the next person on the hit list, because, you know, he has a totally, like, frat boy persona to a lot of people. Like, you know, it's funny, when Family Guy was new, it was kind of edgy or whatever. Now people think of it like an Adam Sandler film, like only reprobates, only jock bro douchebags like it. So I was a little surprised that, in a way, he's getting out ahead of being the next person to be accused of something Weinsteinian. And it's not even like he did it in a calculated way, because it's something he said years ago. You know, it just happens to work for him now.
What do you think will come out of all of this?
I don't know. That's all I could say.
Yeah. We are at the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, Dane Fitzgerald, is there anything else you'd like to add about any of these topics?
No. Yeah, I guess my my angle here is just kind of being in Silicon Valley and, I work down there. And just, I don't know. Yeah, I guess I don't really have any way of summing anything up. I used to write a lot more. But now I work at Samsung and I've gotten older and I've just realized, you know, I just need to, you know, buckle down and just work.
Dane Fitzgerald, thanks for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Yeah, nice talking to you, Robert. Nice talking to you too, Josh.
Yeah, sure. Great to meet you.
Yeah. Where are you at, by the way? I know Robert's in
the I am on the East Coast, undisclosed location.
Okay. Wow. The air is filled with smoke where I live the last few days. The whole West Coast is burning up.
Yeah, I've heard stories.
It looked like Blade Runner. It looked like Blade Runner the other day. It was like a golden sky. It was like, what the hell?